Volume 1, Number 7. Science. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. Going back to Volume 1, Episode 3, on fear, I spoke of how our fear is mostly of the unknown, where there be dragons. Knowing more, shining light into the darkness, should help reduce our fears, and yet many people shun science. The alternative, faith, was little help, as organized religions often use fear to control their followers. After discussing faith in Episode 4, it's time to turn our lens on science. Why are people so resistant to accepting what science has to tell us about the unknown? As a kid, I remember seeing issues of popular science and popular mechanics that heralded a new age of technological wonder, jetpacks, robot maids, and flying cars. The future was going to be just like the Jetsons.
Meet George Jetson.
Through most of the 20th century, people were big on science. It held the promise of a positive future with answers to nature's mysteries and techniques to master the atom. As it turned out, the 20th century also brought the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and quantum physics. Suddenly, the belief that science could find solutions to all the mysteries was shattered. Now it was telling us that it knew for certain that it could never know everything for certain. What a letdown. Scientific positivism had held out the hope that we could even sort out our moral dilemmas with scientific precision. Now we became less sure, and we don't like the unknown. Remember? It's scary. The replacement in the realm of social sciences was relativism. The old idea that absolute truths could be delivered by science had been shaken. So relativism told us that there are no absolute truths. Truth became subjective to the perceptions and cultures of the believers. Who needs science when moral truth is whatever your group decides it is?
You say yes, I say no. You say stop, and I say go, go, go. Oh no. You say goodbye, and I say hello.
Hello.
I don't know why you say goodbye, I say hello. Hello.
In the Orb's forum discussion on the episode on faith, an important question arose. In the podcast, I had said that faith was not about satisfying a spiritual hunger. Rather, it was the basis of the belief that you have a spirit that can be hungry. The question was, what are we hungry for? My answer to that question is that we are hungry for certainty. We find uncertainty, as we do the unknown, to be frightening and unsettling. We want to feel safe, and we feel safe when we are certain of our place and a path forward. Religions are very good at delivering a message of certainty. Provided we accept the message without evidence, we simply choose to trust it, the message satisfies the hunger. Science couches its positions in the language of theories. Science is willing to change its ideas about the truth of things whenever some new piece of evidence comes along. There is no certainty in science. That podcast on faith was focusing on the foundation of belief as being either trust or faith. Another forum post raised the topic of the middle ground between the twin certainties of belief and disbelief, regardless of their basis. This is the realm of mystery, the things we simply don't know. People generally don't like the realm of mystery. It's where the dragons live. As we have an aversion to mystery, we tend to cling to ideologies that espouse certainty. We fight down our doubts and convince ourselves that what we believe is true. We start investing our identity in these ideologies. So where has that left us morally? Moral relativism is unsatisfying. We know in our bones that what some cultures do is just not right. If you identify with a faith, you cling to the moral certainty that it is right, it is true, and everyone else is wrong. Is it morally true that women must wear the burqa when outside the home? Really, absolutely true. It depends on your faith. That is not an absolute truth. It is a relative truth. That's not good enough for me. Now I'm faced with sorting out why that isn't good enough. After all, being raised with moral relativism and considering myself a very tolerant person, why am I not content to let others believe in the righteousness of the burqa, to pick one example? This comes down to another set of beliefs. If you believe in a promised afterlife as set out in the religious text of your choice, then your moral judgments are focused on that afterlife. Really, what's a few short years of living in this world compared to an eternity in heaven or hell? If I believed in that bipolar eternity, I'm sure I'd adhere to whatever the religious text told me to do in this life. I don't believe that. Although many religious people would disagree with me, I don't think they really believe it either. The texts are full of contradictions and instructions that just run against our inherent sense of good and bad behavior. Followers adopt varying levels of devotion to their chosen texts. Some are fundamentalists and advocate for things like Sharia law. They are in the minority, some would even call a lunatic fringe. As I deliver this podcast in English, I expect the majority of my audience has at least some background in Christianity. Do you know anyone that thinks the following is something that is morally right? If any man take a wife and say, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found her not a maid. If this thing be true, and the tokens of virginity be not found for the damsel, then they shall bring out the damsel to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones that she die. The words are condensed from Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 to 21. This is just one sample from one religious text that purports to deliver moral certainty. The righteousness of stoning a woman to death because she was not a virgin on her wedding night is not something I am prepared to say is an absolute moral truth. In fact, I'd stand for saying it is a moral outrage. Moral relativism is a failure. Where to now for certainty? In Sam Harris's book, The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values, he makes the case that there is an empirical good and bad, and that we can use the tools of science to declare moral truths. We have to start by agreeing that we are dealing with moral conduct focused on living well in this life and disregard the objectives of attaining eternal salvation. I'd be willing to bet that we will end up with a lot more common ground and a reasonable shot at receiving God's grace than religious authorities would like to admit. Can we agree that everyone living in absolute misery for all the days of our lives is bad, and that everyone living in bliss all the time is good? If so, then we can use the tools of science, like evidence and logic, to map out a moral landscape. We can use this landscape to both determine where we are and the path forward, with scientific precision. Maybe not quite certainty, but as close as we can hope for. We've always been content to think there are multiple wrong answers to any question. Why should there not be multiple right answers? That there may be multiple right answers to some moral questions does not mean that there isn't a clear distinction between right and wrong. Is there a single right food? No, we eat lots of good things. That there is no single right food does not mean we cannot distinguish food from poison. The science of nutrition is valid. Similarly, scientific tools can be used to establish with evidence and logic that there are morally right and wrong behaviors, behaviors that bring us closer to the good places in the landscape, and behaviors that take us to the bad places. On October 7, 2010, the Center for Inquiry in New York City hosted Sam Harris for a public lecture at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. During the Q&A following the lecture, Michael Dodora of the Center for Inquiry asks Sam Harris about corporal punishment.
If, for instance, there was some sort of study that showed that corporal punishment actually benefited emotional well-being in the long run for children, then we would have to admit that it's moral. Now, a lot of people objected to that in the sense that which it would never be right
to corporally punish
children. So it's a tough situation. I'm wondering kind of what you thought about the response to that.
I think it's an incredibly easy question to answer, because just ask an analogous question. It's worse than corporal punishment. Is it good to slice open the belly of a child? Well, if you're performing an emergency appendectomy, yes. Okay, so the moment you connect it to an actual result that is clearly conducive to the well-being of the child, and you're seeking it as therefore an expression of your love for the child, and you're connected to this child thriving, well then yes, you take out the knife and you, provided you know what the hell you're doing, you perform an appendectomy. Now, that is worse than being beaten with an emergency appendectomy. It's, you know, before, without access to anesthesia, you still have to do it. Okay, it's torture. So yes, if corporal punishment actually were just the best way to produce loving, confident, capable people who look back on their own corporal punishment and say, yeah, I'm just thriving today. I had great parents. That's what the situation we would be in. Now, we're actually not in that situation. We actually know a lot about corporal punishment. A lot is, of course, relative, but there is research on this, and it just doesn't look good on any level.
It's going to be a long, hard climb for science to get back in the game of shaping people's beliefs. We have intrinsic barriers to changing our beliefs and our methods of acquiring them. Chris Mooney, writing in Mother Jones magazine, said, quote, "New discoveries in psychology and neuroscience have demonstrated how our pre-existing beliefs, far more than new facts, can skew our thoughts and even color what we consider our most dispassionate and logical conclusions. This tendency towards so-called motivated reasoning helps explain why we find groups so polarized over matters where evidence is so unequivocal, climate change, vaccines, and much else," unquote. Our minds do not stand alone. We are also emotional creatures. Our emotional response is measurably faster than our reasoning. As it turns out, our fight or flight response applies not only to predators, but to data itself. We put up blocks to accepting new ideas before we allow ourselves to reason with them. By the time we get deliberate about an idea, our emotions have already cleared some ground toward a favored destination. We find it easier to move along that path of thinking than to hack through the dense jungle of steamy discomfort. The result is a tendency to not be objective about science because we're lazy. We're comfortable with the ideas we already have. Why let some data, some probably questionable data, evict us from our happy place? Like the reptile machine I spoke of in the episode on fear, we are happy to sit on our rock in the sun until it becomes too dangerous or frightening to stay. A few facts can be ignored or dismissed as untrustworthy. So here we sit until those facts manifest as an urgent reality, like the tides starting to lap at our doorsteps because ocean levels really are rising. Truth will out. When we do think about something, we draw upon our memories of facts and beliefs to see how they react with the new data. Where a previously held belief is contradicted by the new data, we immediately call on the supports of our old ideas to refute the new. We marshal the army that has been loyal and served us in the past to do battle against this invader. Our tendency is to explain away the new data in terms of what we already believe. What this amounts to is a shift from reasoning through the new data to rationalizing it away. We tend to trust the data that confirms our pre-existing beliefs and dismiss facts that refute them. Our goal is to stay safe and happy, sitting on our rock in the sun. To do that, we place a higher priority on protecting the turf where we have rooted our identity. Factual accuracy be damned. In a classic 1979 experiment, pro- and anti-death penalty advocates were exposed to descriptions of two fake scientific studies, one supporting and one undermining the notion that capital punishment deters violent crime, and in particular murder. They were also shown detailed methodological critiques of the fake studies, and in a scientific sense, neither study was stronger than the other. Yet in each case, advocates more heavily criticized the study whose conclusions disagreed with their own, while describing the study that was more ideologically congenial as more convincing. This same bias is applied to choosing the sources we trust. We trust people that tend to agree with our pre-existing beliefs and distrust opponents. Trusted science has become whatever we want it to be. Our ability to disregard facts and continue to assert a deeply held ideology can be astounding. In March 2010, J.D. Hayworth was running in the Republican Party's Arizona Senate primary against John McCain. Hayworth made news for a comment he had made regarding same-sex marriage. In this interview on The Rachel Maddow Show, he shows a resistance to accept empirical fact to change his belief of what is contained in the public record of a Massachusetts Supreme Court ruling.
This is the comments you made about same-sex marriage. I know you've been asked about this a lot today. Here they are.
You see, the Massachusetts Supreme Court, when it started this move toward same-sex marriage, actually defined marriage. Now, get this. It defined marriage as simply, quote, the establishment of intimacy. Hmm. Now, how dangerous is that? I mean, I don't mean to be absurd about it, but I guess I can make the a point of absurdity with an absurd point. I guess that would mean if you really had affection for your horse, I guess you could marry your horse.
So here's my question about that. Where does the establishment of intimacy thing come from? Where in Massachusetts law or in the Supreme Court ruling does it say the establishment of intimacy? I read, spent the whole afternoon sort of looking for that and couldn't find it anywhere.
Well, as we went back and reviewed that document back when the argument was made, the High Court in Massachusetts defined marriage in a rather amorphous fashion, simply as, quote, the establishment of intimacy. Now, I think we all agree there's much more to marriage than that.
Sir, I'm
and
sorry,
it was on
it,
that
it
predicate
didn't.
That I prefaced my remarks.
I'm sorry.
Okay, and I have a disagreement.
Well, I mean, so I've gone through the Supreme Court ruling, and I found all of the references to the word intimacy, which you can't get to your assertion without using the word intimacy. And it's things like, the United States Supreme Court affirmed that the core concept of common human dignity protected by the 14th Amendment precludes government intrusion into the deeply personal realms of consensual adult expressions of intimacy and one's choice of an intimate partner, quoting the U.S. Supreme Court. Marriage bestows enormous private and social advantages on those who choose to marry. Civil marriage is a deeply personal commitment to another human being and a highly public celebration of the ideals of mutuality, companionship, and intimacy. Those are the kinds of use of the word intimacy. The establishment of intimacy as the definition of marriage, it's just not there. I mean, let alone the horse thing, but which I'll leave you to explain. But what you said about the establishment of intimacy being the definition of marriage in Massachusetts, I don't think it's true, sir.
Well, that's fine. You and I can have a disagreement about that.
Well, it either is true or it isn't. It's empirical.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I appreciate the fact that we have a disagreement on that. I'm sure one of many disagreements we would have. And again, I thank you for the chance to join you.
All right.
To counter these forces of emotion and identity defense, to get to the pure reasoning that science exalts, we have embraced the scientific method, and most importantly, peer review. By exposing ideas to review and revision, we should be able to cancel personal biases and arrive at a sound, factual knowledge. Our resistance army is actually aided by our enemy. Science goes out of its way to express all the nuance, conditions, and detailed constraints on the interpretation of its results. Science has managed to survive the onslaught of religious and cultural opposition by emphasizing that they aren't stating facts, just current theory. Science is always open to revising its position should there be more data come to light. Pussies. The very honesty and open-mindedness of science weakens its ability to push past our defenses. Remember ClimateGate, the 2009 leak of emails from the Climate Research Unit of the University of East Anglia? It launched a furor in both the press and the scientific community. According to skeptics, the emails showed scientists manipulating climate data and suppressing their critics. Six committees investigated the allegations and published reports detailing their findings. None of the inquiries found evidence of fraud or scientific misconduct. Cherry-picking from the massive dump of data is the sort of behavior you would expect from motivated reasoners, the ones that are rationalizing their pre-existing beliefs. Whatever you may think about ClimateGate, the emails were a rich trove of new information upon which to impose one's ideology. Chris Mooney offered some advice in his article in Mother Jones. Quote, "If you want someone to accept new evidence, make sure to present it to them in a context that doesn't trigger a defensive, emotional reaction." In one study, Dan Kahan and colleagues at Yale Law School packaged the basic science of climate change into fake newspaper articles bearing two very different headlines. "Scientific panel recommends anti-pollution solution to global warming," and "Scientific panel recommends nuclear solution to global warming," and then tested how citizens with different values responded. Sure enough, the latter frame made climate change deniers much more open to accepting the fact that humans are causing global warming. Kahan infers that the effect occurred because the science had been written into an alternative narrative that appealed to their pro-industry worldview. You don't lead with the facts to convince, you lead with the values so as to give the facts a fighting chance. Unquote. When I set out from Chicken Harbor to do the Orb, I set a goal of letting the data take me where it would. To quote myself, "The purpose of having things enter your mind is to leave you at some destination. The thinking is the journey." Now, which way to go with that thought? With an open mind, don't the thoughts provide the direction? Only those who have predetermined their destination would try to force the point. This episode has illustrated to me that the thinking is going to be even harder than I thought. When I started collecting notes on our relationship with science, I had things on the abuse of science in advertising and the shoddy state of science journalism. As I researched some more, I ended up with this episode on morality and the myriad biases that affect our thinking. I have to confess that I still carry biases toward the value of evidence and logic in finding truth. These are my weapons of choice in fighting the dragons in the dark. Is it these same biases that have delivered me from relativism back to positivism? At the very least, I have become a little bit more aware of the forces at play. I have become a little less troubled and a bit more curious about the mystery that sits between certainties. Thank you. Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.